Sometimes you just want the quick facts. No opinions, no speculation. I'm Claire Thornton, an audio editor with USA Today. My team works around the clock to bring you the Five Things podcast. Every morning, me and my co-host Taylor Wilson help you know what to keep an eye out for that day. We always have a fresh mix of stories, from politics to entertainment to sports, covering all parts of the country. On Sundays, you can lean back with in-depth episodes about stories you may have heard earlier that week. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite shows and start listening to Five Things today.
Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Protests against the Cuban regime reverberate in Florida. A state law aimed at Black Lives Matter demonstrators gets examined in a new light, and Governor Ron DeSantis touts a new civics education initiative. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and those are some of the stories I'll be discussing today with Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns and Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. But first, that music means it's time for some numbers. Gentlemen, John, how about you? Do you have a number?
Yeah, Zach, my number this week is an even dozen. I'm turning it up to 12 this week.
All right. How about you, Antonio?
John goes low, I go high. I'm going with 100 million.
100 million. And somehow I always seem to be in the middle here. Mine is 100,000. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, crowds have gathered across Florida this week to demonstrate in support of anti-government protesters in Cuba. There have been big demonstrations in Miami and smaller gatherings everywhere from here in Sarasota to over in Lakeland and many places across the state. The situation in Cuba is being described as an important inflection point for the island, and many Floridians are deeply invested in what happens there. Florida leaders such as Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, have been vocal about the situation on the island. Antonio, how big of a deal are these recent developments in Cuba, and how does Florida factor into this moment in Cuban history?
Well, Zach, you know, they're a huge deal because they are the biggest political challenge to Cuba's communist government since the transition away from the Castro brothers. Their dictatorship, which concluded this year when Raul Castro, the surviving brother, relinquished the country's top job, which is the head of the Communist Party that effectively runs the country and the government. He did that back in the spring and was replaced by handpicked leader Miguel Díaz-Canel. Now, some media outlets have reported these protests are unprecedented. They are not. The Castros encountered similar challenges over the decades and then just crushed them with jailings and executions and sending people to Florida and around the world in exile. What is different here is the role that social media has played and the way the country's citizenry was able to broadcast their uprising to the world. Cuba state-run media couldn't manage the typical playbook, which was to deny anything was happening, that Cuba was a paradise, and there was nothing to see here. And they couldn't do that because Cubans on the island were disseminating images and messages via social media that prompted more people to speak out and march in the streets. Then we saw something we haven't seen, something that really was unprecedented, and that we saw the leader of the country, Díaz-Canel, host this roundtable press conference to address popular quote-unquote dissatisfaction, everything from power outages to COVID infections to food shortages. Now, Díaz-Canel lacks the charisma that late Fidel Castro had. He is a technocrat, and this choreographed press conference was long and dull, and he also blamed everything ultimately on the U.S. economic blockade. Nevertheless, for the first time, we saw Cuban government officials acknowledge popular protest and explain themselves. And as we have said many times on this podcast, in politics, if you're explaining, you ain't winning. Tragically, though, then came the crackdown. The Instituto San Isidro, a human rights group, this week issued pages and pages with the names of activists, journalists, and social media influencers and others who have gone missing or have been detained by Cuban authorities. There was also this horrific viral video Wednesday of a purported activist who was shot and then inhumanely carried out of his home with his family watching. As such, this movement, this peaceful popular uprising, hangs in the balance. It's life and death for a lot of people in Cuba right now. And this is where the high stakes also come in for the Biden administration and Florida's GOP elected officials, because the question is, what now? So far, the Biden administration has simply issued statements of support. That ain't much, folks. And if the Cuban government successfully crushes this uprising like the others, the President Biden and the Democrats can pretty much kiss off Florida in 2022, 2024, 2026. You kind of get the picture. There are also high stakes for Florida GOP leaders. One of them is Marco Rubio. All eyes are on him right now. So, Senator, what is your menu of options? Well, Rubio issued a video on Twitter this week with four steps he wants the Biden administration to take. They include using technology to restore internet service across Cuba, getting the Organization of American States and the United Nations Security Council to condemn Cuba's crackdown of the uprising, and also to get the Biden administration, the U.S. government, to issue a clear call that weaponizing immigration, sort of like a Mario Boatlift-like exodus, will not be tolerated. Now, here's the thing. Two of those options, the OAS and the UN, called on international globalist organizations to act. Well, aren't these the same, aren't these among the corrupt globalist organizations that the now America First Republican Party has been condemning for the past 4 years? And Rubio didn't respond to what I have heard Cubans in the streets calling for, namely military intervention. That was the point of the protest that shut down a key highway in Tampa on Tuesday. And the people who were there were calling for military action. That's a political no way for today's America First, no more endless wars with GOP. To be sure, Democrats aren't making that argument either. U.S. Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, a Cuban American, said as much. But Rubio's point is absolutely right. What is happening in Cuba is turning into a tragedy and will be a catastrophe if the uprising is crushed. That much everyone agrees with. And if so, the suffering in Cuba will be unfathomable, and the political fallout here in Florida will be broad.
Antonio, the last thing you mentioned, weaponizing immigration, can you explain that? I wasn't exactly clear what that means.
Yeah, but basically what Rubio said and others have said as well is that what happens in these uprisings is they crush it. And basically the message that the Cuban government sends to citizenry is, hey, if you don't like it, leave. Florida is 90 miles away. And then people get in rafts and they get in boats and you have this humanitarian crisis on the high seas. Plus you have, you know, ever since Mariel, there has been a desire to crack down on these boat lifts. And in fact, under Obama, you know, first under Clinton, there was a move, the wet foot, dry foot, that if you were in the high seas, you were stopped and returned to Cuba. If you made it to Florida, then you were allowed to stay. Under Obama, that changed. So where it was no more anybody, you know, we're not going to allow unrestricted immigration into the country. If you want to come to the U.S., you have to go through this lottery process in Havana, get a visa, and like everybody else. So that's what they're trying to do, is make sure that there's not a Mariel Boatlift. Now, the problem is, in the Mariel Boatlift, the reason that happened the way it did is because Cubans in Miami jumped on boats, went to Cuba, picked up people to bring here. So it's not exactly the same apples to apples, but what he's talking about is not allowing the Cuban government to basically open the spigot and have a massive wave of immigration that is unrestricted, that is uncontrolled, just show up on our shores.
And that's kind of, I mean, for Cubans in the past, a lot of people who were unhappy ended up leaving, right? I mean, that's kind of what's so remarkable about this, is that instead of leaving, people are choosing to stand up and voice, you know, their dissatisfaction with this oppressive government.
Well, yeah, and I think that's happened in the past. That's what the stages here is. You have the uprising, and then it's crushed, and then, you know, X number of people end up in prison, and X number of people are forced out of the country. What's different here is that we've been able to watch this unfold on our social media outlets, and that, you know, and that the Cubans in the country have been able to communicate that way and show each other what they're doing, and that's why you've had. It wasn't just Havana. It was across the entire country.
Well, whatever happens in Cuba always has a big impact on Florida. There are so many Cuban immigrants here and Cuban elected leaders, Cuban-American elected leaders. So this is something that we'll have to be watching closely because, this state is obviously the closest to Cuba, has the closest relationship with Cuba, and, the politics in Cuba, are critical here and will probably play a big role in the upcoming election. Some of the Florida demonstrations in support of Cuban protesters have spilled out into the streets, with one group of demonstrators in Miami, as Antonio mentioned, even blocking a major highway. That's led to a lot of discussion about how a new law pushed by Governor Ron DeSantis in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests applies to the current situation. Part of the law creates a new penalty for those who obstruct roadways. Some Democrats question whether the current demonstrations, which many Republicans are sympathetic to, are being treated the same as the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. John, you've been looking into this. What have you found?
Well, there's clearly some frustration, particularly from members of the Legislative Black Caucus, who said they and their constituents felt singled out by the state's new anti-protest law, which supporters call an anti-riot measure. Governor DeSantis, you remember, called for this new law last fall when the Black Lives Matter protests were still very hot around the nation. They all followed the George Floyd death at the hands of Minneapolis police. Some of these protests had turned violent, and DeSantis made a point of standing up for the side of law enforcement and business owners in calling for tougher sanctions against violent protests. Now, you know, most in Florida were fairly tame, you know, but across the nation, DeSantis seized on what was being shown on television screens across the nation to sort of raise this issue with voters. Now, DeSantis is saying that these demonstrations in support of the Cuban people are much different situations. But, you know, are they? As you point out, Zach, you know, so far there have been at least two arrests for battery on law enforcement officers, and highways and roads have been blocked in Miami, Tampa, Orlando, Fort Myers area, Sarasota. The new, anti-riot law prohibits such road blockages and sets $15 civil penalties for those offenses. Now, battery on law enforcement can draw enhanced criminal penalties under the law, which also creates new crimes like mob intimidation and unlawful assembly involving three or more people involved in disorderly conduct. Now, these two Tampa area men arrested also are being held without bail for at least a day until a first appearance in court, because they were charged with unlawful assembly as well as battery on a police officer. Now, they look like they're maybe going to be the first people charged under this law. Still, State Rep Fentress Driscoll, she's a Tampa Democrat who is black, opposes the new law, but she said that DeSantis is being hypocritical in calling for the tougher new law when black protesters, who tend not to be his voters, when they protest, but supporting those who are now rallying for Cuba, many of them Cuban Americans, who indeed do tend to be his voters. The ACLU of Florida, which is among several civil rights organizations that are suing in federal court to overturn the new anti-riot law, said that Floridians' right to protest should not be subject to Governor DeSantis's wavering politics. And the co-leader of the state House Democrats, that's Representative Bobby DeBose of Fort Lauderdale, he told me the governor sees it through two different lenses. These two Americas, he called it, that the governor sees people that look like him, that look like Bobby DeBose, when they demonstrate, he calls for this law. And he sees it as completely unnecessary, says DeBose. But, you know, there's bitter irony that the first test of the state's new protest law comes when it's one of the Republican Party's staunchest supporters. The Cuban Americans have been loyal to Republicans in this state and across the nation since, you know, going way back to the 60s, arguably. And, you know, they are now taking to the streets. So for now, DeSantis is what seems to be his approach is he's trying to keep the attention on the demonstrations in Havana, you know, and trying to downplay the impact of what's going on in Miami or Tampa or Orlando or many other Florida cities.
John, does it undermine this law if it's not enforced evenly? I mean, I think I've read some lawyers say that, you know, there are cases of this law being enforced in the future, they'll point to what happened now and say, well, They didn't really use this law then. Why are they using it now? I mean, if you don't enforce it evenly, does it undermine the law, do you think?
Well, that's a good question, and I've asked that as well. It's a little bit of a case-by-case basis, I guess. It's akin to, you know, how some people get away with speeding offenses while others get caught. But at the same time, it does. It casts a cloud over the credibility of this when it's being selectively enforced. And, of course, this law is the subject of a federal challenge, and we don't really know where it's going to wind up, whether the ACLU just yesterday filed for a preliminary injunction to try to stop it from being enforced altogether, at least temporarily. So we'll see how that shakes out. But it's a, it's wildly controversial, was very opposed. It passed almost strictly along party lines, with Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed to it. And now, ironically, one of the most loyal Republican cohorts is on the streets protesting.
Antonio, there was a big highway down in Miami that was blocked by these protesters. What's going on down there? What are you hearing?
Well, Zach, I mean, the question is, why are Cuban Americans here in Florida marching in the streets in Florida in the first place? Think of it. How does shutting down Interstate 75 and North Fort Myers or the Palmetto Expressway in Miami-Dade County, how does that bring down the Cuban communist regime? The answer is that Cuban Americans, and I will include myself here, although I have personally disagreed with the policy for many years, we've left ourselves with no other option because we have held on to the same Cold War policy menu. That is, namely, the policy with the unintended consequence that isolates Cuban Americans largely from Cuba. Imagine if this community, if we had not supported the Trump administration's and previous administration's efforts to curtail freer travel to Cuba, or those policies that hampered the ability to get money and resources to people in Cuba. Imagine if instead of marching in streets in Florida, imagine patriotic Cuban Americans here could have been in Havana or Santa Clara or Santiago and all those cities all along. I mentioned Marco Rubio's suggestion earlier of immediately using technology to get internet service restored in Cuba. By the way, Rubio's potential 2022 rival, Congresswoman Val Demings, made the same call Thursday after a meeting with Cuban American civic leaders in Orlando. Great idea, but why did it take until 2021 for that policy option to be on the table? In fact, let's talk a little bit about U.S.-sponsored mass communications in Cuba. It's not internet or social media. No, señores. It's radio and TV, Marti. Yes, we're spending millions of dollars on the best technology that the middle of the 20th century has to offer. By the way, Díaz-Canel, the technocratic president, he didn't blame radio and TV, Marti, for the unrest. He said it was the YouTubers and the social media influencers. That's what he said on Tuesday. We're spending in the neighborhood of $14 million on mass media in Cuba that has nothing to do with what even the communist technocrat leader of the country called the most potent force for change on the island. That Cuban Americans are having to resort to blocking traffic is the ultimate sign that this Cold War menu of options has been a mistake in the 21st century. And not even talking about the embargo, which as a U.S. taxpayer, I'm not crazy about lifting. I'm talking about a policy menu that is old and dated and, worst of all, isolated Cuban Americans from a political movement that they should have been engaged in the entire time. Cuban Americans are blocking traffic because we have embraced a policy menu that really gives us no other role in this uprising. That Rubio has now correctly said, and he's right, it's become a tragedy, and it could become a catastrophe with us literally just marching on the sidelines in Florida.
It does seem like everybody agrees that there needs to be an effort to get more, restore the internet in Cuba. It's just it'll be interesting to see how they go about that and whether technologically it can be done. Well, another hot button issue that Governor DeSantis broached this week was civics education. The governor had earlier vetoed a civics education bill that conservative groups didn't like, and he's also been outspoken about opposing critical race theory, but he finally found a civics proposal that he does like. John, what does the future of civics education look like under DeSantis?
That's a good question, Zach. The civics has had a bumpy ride lately under DeSantis. This week he went to an Orlando charter school to promote the need for civics education with a $106 million program that includes $3,000 bonuses for teachers who complete special training and earn the new Florida Civic Seal of Excellence. He bemoaned the knowledge skills of many young people predominantly who in surveys struggle, you know, to correctly respond to questions about the nation's three branches of government, constitutional matters, and history. DeSantis said that the understanding of many students was, the quote was, pretty doggone dismal. And he said that we've got to do better as a society. But DeSantis' approach to the topic of civics, though, has followed a course that, you know, would be probably most familiar to anyone who's read Goldilocks, except DeSantis seemed to be getting most of his guidance from conservative media. Remember, he vetoed a civics literacy program that had been unanimously passed by the legislature, supported by members of both parties, that would have encouraged high school students to use methods of active participation in society, government, and the political system. Those are the words of the bill. But, you know, it's kind of ambiguous academic language, maybe, but not to the conservative National Review, which wrote that the bill would bring what it called action civics to Florida. And that was, in their view, urging students to participate in protests and the like. The equally conservative Heritage Foundation also didn't like the bill, and DeSantis, when he vetoed it, in his veto message, mentioned action civics, and he described the preferred orthodoxy of two particular institutions. And now the only institutions mentioned in the bill are the University of South Florida's St. Petersburg campus and the YMCA. So it's hard to tell what kind of hard left manifestos are being plotted at these places. But DeSantis, you know, he followed the hard right message of getting rid of this legislation. And that came, you know, just a few weeks after what he had done earlier when he pushed the state's Board of Education to ban, you remember, critical race theory from being taught in Florida schools. Now, it's not being taught directly, but this concept that explores racial injustice, slavery, and, you know, the remnants of their presence that are still seen in our society, that has been demonized by Fox News and others. And DeSantis joined in by making sure it won't see light of day in Florida. Something like the anti-riot law was, you know, again, it was like the equal opposition from Florida black leaders, and who were joined in by educators of all races, saying that, you know, you can't short circuit what is being taught in schools. But, you know, here he is with a new civics law and teacher bonuses that he seems to have found a civics curriculum that he apparently likes. Now, you know, of course, DeSantis is getting his own hands-on lesson in civics from federal courts, which have so far blocked two bills that he has signed into law this year. His priority social media law, which allowed for penalties against platforms that, you know, had banned former President Trump, and another law that would have limited campaign contributions to citizen ballot initiatives. But, you know, both were seen as having constitutional problems by the court. So they're, you know, given his early summer track record so far, maybe DeSantis is not the best person around to be deciding what kind of civics education young Floridians should be getting.
John, I'm just surprised that you didn't know that the YMCA was behind the Black Lives Matter protest. Everybody knows that. Like, I know, I belong to the gym there. When I go there, it's just MSNBC and all the TVs are just tuned to liberal propaganda.
Yeah, I know. Just imagine. I know. YMCA is much more than a Village People song.
Well, we'll move on to some numbers here. Antonio, you want to tell us about yours?
Gentlemen, $100 million is basically the amount of money that a judge this week said the property where the doomed Champlain Tower South complex once stood. That's the amount of money this judge thinks that property might be resold for. Now, there has been a lot of talk about what to do with that property once it has been cleared of all the debris, and that once that the victims have all been removed and grieving families are allowed to get some closure and then be allowed to mourn in peace. There has also been discussion about what to do with that property and the families of those who died, as well as the people who are now completely displaced by the building's collapse. And, you know, they have all been kind of at the forefront of that discussion. One thought could be that the property could be sold, as this judge cleared the way for, and then redeveloped, and the money the sale generated could go into a fund for those who loved lost ones, those who lost loved ones, and those who lost their homes and every possession they owned. Now, $100 million looks like it'd go a long way, but even if you got the $100 million evenly distributed to the 300 plus people impacted. It's about $300,000 per person, both to those who are alive and to the estate of those who have died. That's less than what some condos in that building were selling for before the building crumbled. Some were selling for well over $700,000, which is where one of the long-term impacts of this still hard-to-fathom tragedy will probably begin to reverberate: the property and casualty insurance market. Just this week, Citizens Property Insurance Corporation President and CEO Barry Gilway warned the board that if more faulty buildings are uncovered, the state could force condominium associations to look for new insurers. And that means more policies and risk and liabilities for the insurer of last resort in Florida, Citizens. If so, look, this is going to raise a lot of questions about coverage and risk assessments and actuarial reviews and, well, create quite an insurance conundrum for a state that has had more than its share of home insurance and property casualty issues in the past, particularly with hurricanes. So, you know, this has been an incredible tragedy. It's hard to fathom it. But, you know, even once those who have lost, you know, their loved ones, once that they're getting closure and they're finally being able to mourn in peace, I think we may see that the impact of this disaster may reverberate in Florida for some time.
Yeah, and insurance is one of those areas. Building codes is another area that we've talked about. It's definitely could have an impact on a variety of different things that impact property owners. John, your number was 12. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Zach, 12 is $12, and that's what it will cost you to order a pair of Don't Fauci My Florida beverage coolers, what I think are usually called koozies, on those being sold on Governor Ron DeSantis' new campaign merchandise site. Now, the governor hasn't officially announced his candidacy for reelection or for president or for anything for that matter, but this week he's opened a Team DeSantis merchandise shop. The themes of the hats, the T-shirts, the flags are all about Keep Florida Free, which apparently the governor thinks he has successfully done through the COVID-19 pandemic and much more. But taking on Fauci also is part of this for that base of DeSantis voters who, like those who, like Trump, don't like vaccines, mask wearing, or business closures. You can get a Don't Fauci My Florida T-shirt for $21 on DeSantis' site. Even as with the spread of the Delta variant, COVID cases in Florida were up 51.5% last week. Now, our Yale and Harvard-educated governor has always been inclined to see himself as smarter than the scientists who have been attempting to guide us through what is now year two of the pandemic. But, you know, now you can get a T-shirt or beer koozie that shows what you think of Dr. Fauci. This comes... Though, you know, it's funny because DeSantis is getting his own heat from the right. The Republican presidential possibles seem to be trying to outdo themselves on being anti-science. You had South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem recently managed to get a dig in on her potential rivals DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who both did have more COVID restrictions than wide open South Dakota did. Now, of course, South Dakota's COVID rate as a percentage of its population was astronomical. But Noem was critical of unnamed Republican governors who are trying, as she said, to rewrite history by saying that they didn't shut down their states, which, of course, DeSantis did for a month, and mandate masks, which he did not statewide, but he did allow local governments to order for a while. Now, Noem also has been taking on Fauci, saying he's been wrong a lot. So, you know, if there's one thing clear, it seems that the path to the 2024 Republican presidential nomination goes directly over Anthony Fauci.
Don't Fauci My Florida, DFMF. Not quite MAGA, but we'll see if it catches on.
That's right. It may.
My number is 100,000. That's how much federal rental assistance money Florida has distributed through the end of May, according to a recent report by the U.S. Treasury Department. That 100,000 is just a tiny fraction of the $871 million Florida received from the federal government in February for rental assistance as part of a program approved by Congress last year and signed by former President Donald Trump that would help people facing eviction because of pandemic-related financial hardships. A federal eviction moratorium is set to expire at the end of this month, and there are concerns about a big wave of pent-up evictions. That's why the slow start to Florida's rental assistance program, which only began processing applications on May 17th, could mean that the state will be playing catch-up when it comes to forestalling an eviction crisis. Florida gave out less money for rental assistance through the end of May than 41 other states. Even tiny Guam, a U.S. island territory, gave out more rental assistance money than Florida. The rental aid program began ramping up a little bit in June and July with another $3.8 million awarded to Florida renters, but it's still just a tiny, tiny fraction of the amount of money that the state has received from the federal government to help people facing eviction. State's still behind the eight ball when it comes to preventing these evictions, and that can cause a lot of disruption for Florida families. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.